Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's event. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm director of the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE. On behalf of the Hellenic Observatory and the Faith Center here at the school, it is a great honor to welcome His Eminence Archbishop Nikitas. His Eminence was elected Archbishop of Thyatira and Great Britain. Signore, I've got that. That wasn't the best pronunciation. I will please accept that. He's been with us since June 2019. It is a great honor to welcome him to the school. It's also a great pleasure to be joined by my colleague, Professor James Walters, who is director of the LSE Faith Center here at the school. And it's a pleasure to welcome Father Alexander, who's been the Orthodox chaplain at the school for more years than perhaps he would publicly wish to admit. Our topic tonight is indeed topical and provocative. Does Europe need religion? For some, of course, religion is a source of much conflict and a barrier to social cohesion. For others, religion defines our very identity, gives us meaning to our lives and our relationship with wider society. Archbishop Nikitas is very well placed to address these issues and more. He can draw upon a wide experience of learning and a broad range of activities. His Eminence was born in Tampa, Florida. He was active in the church throughout his youth. He studied at the University of Florida and then at the Holy Cross Greek Orthodox School of Theology. He gained a Master of Divinity with honors and then later studied at the University of Thessaloniki for 2 years. He further studied the Russian language at St. Petersburg Theological Seminary in Russia. And in 1987, he became the Chancellor of the Greek Orthodox Diocese of Chicago, Illinois. During this time, he also served as a lecturer in Orthodox theology at Loyola University in Chicago. Archbishop Nikitas was the Metropolitan of Hong Kong and Southeast Asia from 96 to 2007. Later, he became the Metropolitan of the Dardanelles and a hierarch of the ecumenical throne. Archbishop Nikitas serves as in numerous important areas, including as the coordinator of the Patriarchal Task Force on Human Trafficking and Modern-Day Slavery. He is the chairman of the Committee on Youth for the Ecumenical Patriarchate and co-chair and steering committee member of the Elijah Interfaith Foundation. He's also received numerous commendations for his involvement and leadership in interfaith dialogue. It is a great pleasure to host him. Let me just explain something of the format for this evening. In a moment, I'm going to ask His Eminence to speak to the topic. My colleague, Jim Walters, will then engage him in discussion afterwards, and we'll leave time for questions, Q&A with you, the audience. If I could just mention a couple of housekeeping suggestions. If you could possibly put your phones on mute, I'm sure the rest of us would appreciate that. For those of you who wish to pass comments on X, formerly known as Twitter, then the hashtag we suggest is hashtag LSE Religion. Tonight's event is being live streamed, and I think others are watching from another room. They're also very welcome. Tonight's event is also being recorded so that others will be able to download the podcast and watch it at their leisure later. And afterwards, after our discussion on such important topics, we invite all of you to join us outside this theatre for a wine reception. Let me just simply add that you're all very welcome to this wine reception. Do recall that it is an LSE wine reception, and perhaps I could just manage your expectations in terms of the quality of the wine that you might be served. But it's the convivial conversation which is the important thing, rather than materialistic concerns of that kind. So, does Europe need religion? It is an honour to invite His Eminence to come and address us, please.
Thank you very much. And let me start by thanking LSE and thanking the Faith Center and the Hellenic Observatory for the gracious invitation to be here with you. I'm not sure how many of you are Orthodox here this evening, but I will do my best to use terms which are understood by all. I apologize for the American accent, but when you're born with some things, you have to use them to your advantage. It is indeed a pleasure and a blessing for me to be here with you and to share some thoughts with you on the subject, does Europe need religion? You must remember that I'm speaking to you as a clergyman. And of course, what else would a clergyman speak about but religious topics? But I'm speaking to you more specifically as an Orthodox clergyman. Eastern Orthodox, that is. Sometimes we say we're Orthodox. Someone will say, oh, you're Jewish. Not exactly so. But I'm a Greek Orthodox clergyman born in the United States. And my comments, my thoughts, my statements are what I believe, what I feel, and what I wish to share with you. They're not comments of judgment, but I see the world through the eyes of my own faith, and I wish to share that with you this evening. And while we may be of different faith traditions, some of you may even be atheists, I'm sure we share many of the same concerns in life, because after all, this world belongs to all of us. And one of our goals as human beings is to leave the world a better place than we found it when we were born. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be reality. The world seems to be going down the tube, if I might use that expression, as we see the problems, the wars, and the other issues which challenge our societies. But I'm here to share my concerns with you in some ways, so that I can also correct some misconceptions. I used to teach as well. I taught theology. And I always told my students, be sure you know what the church teaches and not what you think it teaches. That's one of the great problems today. People think they know what a church, a tradition, a faith believes and or teaches. And yet there are many times misconceptions. In order for us to get to our goal, to answer the question, does Europe need religion? We need to understand true religion, because there are many examples of very bad religion, and religion which is not true, but we'll get that later. We need to examine the past so we might move into the present and hopefully move into the future. And you who are of a younger generation or two, hopefully will gain some wisdom and see the world and faith and religion, and even our societies in a different way. Religion in the past is that which offered law. It offered stability. Religion offered order for the world, especially here in Europe. All you have to do is open the scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures. For in the beginning, when God created the world, there was chaos. And God brought chaos into order. And from that point, there were directives to put order into the world and into society, public order. And that is not to say that there weren't abuses along the line. There were many abuses, and there continue to be abuses today. However, we're not going to focus on the abuses, because the faith tradition, religion, aims at teaching the truth and what is good. All we have to do is open the scriptures and look at the commandments. The commandments which were given to us so that we might live as human beings and we might live in peace and in tranquility, one person with the other. Not to steal, not to covet. Ideologies, philosophies, which try to keep society, not in a bad way by restriction, but in a good way so society could move on one generation after another. Of course, in time, especially in Europe, Christian ideals and values came along. Because while Christianity has its origin in the Middle East, we know that it moved especially into the European continent. Even though we must also remember that Northern Africa was once an area of Christian. And also India. Tradition tells us that the Apostle Thomas went there and preached and spoke. But Christianity began to change society in ways that you might never have thought of. Have you ever heard of the law of Yaroslav in 1016 or so? And one of the issues found there is that capital punishment was abolished over 1,000 years ago. Unfortunately, there where it was abolished, it has now returned. Unfortunately, our societies throughout the world, at least some of them, choose to allow for capital punishment, even though we're supposed to be a just and civil world and civil societies. But Christianity offered different values. It offered ideals, and Christianity offered something else, hope. Always for a better tomorrow. And that came into Europe and European society. But Christianity did things also on a practical level. When we're sick, we go to the hospital. The dying go to hospice. Those who are hungry go to food banks and other institutions. Those are products of Christianity and the churches. All you have to do is read the works of Saint Basil the Great and his contemporaries. Some of you might say, and who is that? My answer to you is go explore it this evening or tomorrow. But Christianity taught love to be expressed in a real way, not only through a philosophical ideal or ideology, but in concrete measures. And that was because there was the basic principle of love. Saint Agathon says, your love should be so great that you should find a leper and take on his body. Can you imagine doing such a thing? But we thank God that leprosy is disappearing on the face of the world. But Christianity also provided inspiration, and it taught us about justice and a just society. Being an American, I would certainly have to comment on the civil rights movement. And that came out of the churches and religious leaders, because it is often religious leaders who look to society and what is necessary to make the world better. True religious leaders are not afraid to challenge society and to challenge the world and political leaders. But Christianity also did something else on the European continent. It inspired art. If you've ever been to Rome, certainly you've seen the Sistine Chapel. And you've seen the works of Botticelli. You've seen the works of Titian. Or maybe you've been to Greece and you've gone to the Acropolis and you've seen the Parthenon. You know, that place where some of the marble pieces are missing. That's not a political statement. It's just a true statement. But you've seen these works and others, and they were inspired by Christianity and religious leaders. You've seen the works of Da Vinci, and not the Da Vinci Code and other stupidities, but the real works that were produced to make and gladden the heart and fulfill it. Certainly, you've read Geoffrey Chaucer, haven't you? And you've read the prologue to the Canterbury Tales. And Geoffrey Chaucer says, "So pricketh him nature in her courages, then longen folk to go on pilgrimages." People used to go on pilgrimages. So religion actually inspired religious tourism. People went from one place to another, and there became an exchange of language, ideals, personalities, philosophies, thoughts. And that's because of religion and religious sites. But Christianity and the religious traditions did much more than that. You know that the alphabet went into the Slavic lands because of missionaries. The two brothers, Cyril or Kirill and Methodios, they left their native land. They left Thessaloniki to go and to preach, but also they established a means of communication. And that came because of the church. Do we have anyone who's Irish in the group? No one. Then you must all read or tell your friends about a wonderful book, which is called How the Irish Saved Civilization. And if you'll allow me to quote from the book. "From the fall of Rome to the rise of Charlemagne, the Dark Ages, learning, scholarship, and culture disappeared from the European continent. The great heritage of Western civilization, from Greek and Roman classics to Jewish and Christian works, would have been utterly lost were it not for the holy men and women of unconquered Ireland. In this delightful and illuminating book into a crucial but little known hinge of history, Thomas Cahill takes us to the island of saints and scholars, the island of St. Patrick and the Book of Kells. Here, far from the barbarian despoliation of the continent, monks and scholars laboriously, lovingly, even painfully preserve the West written treasury. With the return of stability in Europe, these Irish scholars were instrumental in spreading learning." So you see that religious people preserve not only literature, but culture, the classics, theology, philosophy, mathematics, and so much more. These people preserved what we have today. And through their efforts and the efforts of others, especially in the religious orders, we now have what we call universities. You who study here and those who studied in universities owe your education to the monastic and religious orders. But religion did other things. It helped educate people. And religion taught people about language. Certainly, you know the great archetypes of literature. Many of them come from the scriptures. All you have to do is read the books, The Grapes of Wrath. There are so many other books that contain these archetypes, which come from religious traditions. You know, even grammar and the various expressions in it were taught by knowing the Bible. Because certainly you know the best example of parallelism. I'm sure you know it, but I'll remind you of it. It happens to be found in the book of Ruth. And there we hear the following words: where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Parallelism was learned because of the scriptures. And we today have inherited all of these great things because of our love, not only for scripture, but also for religion. Those are issues of the past. And we come to the present. And I must be honest and say, it's a bit disappointing, disheartening in some ways, to look at the present. Because people study computer science, mathematics, engineering. The humanities have become not only second, but maybe third on the list. Even language. We've forgotten those things, so necessary and so beautiful, so we might have a fulfilled life. But we are the inheritors of these great traditions, and religious people and religious societies back then, 1,000 years ago or even more, were much different than the Europe that we know today and experience. Their experiences were originally pagan against pagan, idolaters, maybe Jewish or something else. But eventually, with the spread of Christianity, we see that societies are changed, especially as religious communities begin to grow. Statistics tell us that the demographics have changed. Just think what this country was 500 years ago, and look at it now. Diverse, a place of languages, a place of cultures, even a place of different cuisines. And that comes because of our travel and our changes. Europe, though, these days is facing some very serious challenges. And we see those challenges being magnified in many ways. Unfortunately, some of those challenges, those problems have to do with religion and the misunderstanding of religion, the rise of fanaticism and poor leadership. But Europe today is not a Christian society. It is a multitude of societies. It is Christian and Jewish. It's Muslim and Buddhist. It's atheist. It's agnostic. and so much more. Recent surveys tell us that present-day France, 40% or so of the population no longer believes in anything. The Czech Republic, 37%. Sweden, 34%. And on down the line. You may remember that recently, for the first time in history, England is no longer a Christian nation. Less than half of the people claim to be Christian. It means that we are a changing society, religious and irreligious. But I think we are also a society of people who are culturally religious. They identify in one way or another with religious practices, religious traditions, and claim to be of a faith tradition. Well, I'm not a practicing Orthodox, but I still am an Orthodox. Very unusual for me to hear those sorts of comments. Not only as a clergyman, but there are clear-cut lines. Either you are or you are not. There's no gray in some things. So we are these people then, with these various societies and communities. And together, through our religion and religious experiences, we want to build a just society and a true society that teaches true religion. We are people who share visions. We are people who share ideals and philosophies. Believe it or not, I'm one of those people who believes that there should not be prayer in the school system. The school teaches you mathematics, a language, grammar, perhaps arithmetic or something else. Your parents and your religious tradition teach you to pray. Because we're not going to pray to an unknown God or some mystical figure. We at least believe we know our God, and we address our prayers to God in a very personal manner. It is a time when we as community leaders, religious leaders, and leaders of religious societies are yearning for peace. Doesn't every major religious group in the world say we promote peace? Peace amongst all people? If that's true, how come we're living in a world of war, a world of division, and sadly, a world where religious communities play a great part in the problems, the war, the conflicts, and so much else? It is a day and time when we as religious leaders don't want to talk about tolerance and religious tolerance. We want to talk about acceptance. Tolerance means I put up with you. But I don't need to put up with people. I want people to embrace me and respect me the same way that I should embrace and respect them. And together, we try to build a better world that's suffering. A world that is suffering and there seems to be no healing. That's why religious communities come together and operate food banks. Or we look at the marginalized, those with problems, and we try to address their challenges, their issues, because some marginalized groups have no voice. And it is our responsibility as religious people to speak for them. And to speak for them on this continent and in the European Union. People have the right to to elect their representatives. You must think carefully for whom you will vote. Does that person embrace the values of a true religion? Does that individual look for justice and what is right? Does that individual live according to the law of God? Because don't forget, I'm speaking as a religious leader, and I have to look at things in that manner and in that dimension. Our realities also tell us that people are searching. People are looking for something. I was at a roundtable discussion not too long ago with Christian religious leaders, and they were all bemoaning the fact that their churches, their constituencies, their congregations are shrinking. And they asked me, what about you? I said, well, I'm sorry to tell you this, we're growing. And we're growing for a variety of reasons, but I won't go into that. But it tells us indeed that people are searching for something. And we need to be able to give them the answers in truth. We see also that part of our realities are that we're living in a world of failed political leadership. It's a general statement not only about Europe, but the world. Failed political leadership. Where are we going and where are we headed? And we need to address those things. And one of the reasons we have this failure is because we have the lack of not only true religion, but the lack of true leadership. We are a world where the individual matters, me, and what's good and necessary for me. We turned a blind eye to what Scripture tells us and where we should be going as religious communities. We failed to hear the words of the prophet Isaiah that the UN knows about, but doesn't put into practice. And they shall bend their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And yet I ask you to look at the budgets of all the great nations of the world, where their money is, where the finances are. And then look at how much is given to alleviate poverty, to promote stability, to fight hunger, injustice, modern day slavery. But we continue to build war machines, bombs, and not only to build them, but to export them to others. And our philosophy and ideology is that the big fish shall eat the little fish. And the world goes on. Europe is different now. Europe is becoming and is a body without a soul. It is thought what is good for me, my own needs, the needs of my country, and we have forgotten the other. Christianity does not view life and the world in that manner. And the goals of modern Europe in many ways are in opposition to true religion. We see the rise of nationalism. We see the rise of populism. We see other extreme ideologies coming out of Europe. Not too long ago, we saw the end of World War II. We saw at one point the building of the Berlin Wall, and it came down. And now, in the heart of Europe, we hear about divisions. We hear about those immigrants, those migrants, the unwanted, the lepers in many ways of a society. And true religion and true Christianity could never say that. But the extreme conservative movements are pushing us that way. We are becoming and are a society of greed and ownership. The ownership of land. To whom does it belong? The earth is the Lord's and thereof. But we try to divide it and make it our own. And mine are not political statements. My statements are those of reality. So where will we go from here? And ask ourselves, does Europe need religion? There's a book called Bad Religion. And it's written by someone in the United States. And it examines U.S. Christianity and focuses on trends and personalities. And it brings us to an understanding that many of the things discussed in that book are now the reality of Europe and European societies. There are people who are great salesmen of salvation. It's very interesting that Jesus said, take what you have and sell it and give it to the poor and come follow me. And now they say, write me a check or cash is better and I'll think about accepting you. And we become part of these cult-like movements because we follow these salesmen of salvation. And their bad religion is a distortion, not only of Christian truth, about the basic principles of life. It's filled with abuses. And individuals and personalities are parallel United States to what we're now seeing in Europe. And these people, in all religions, can lift up society and direct people into war, into all sorts of problems. True religion, though, offers hope, especially in the Christian understanding. Hope for change, hope for new leadership, hope for answers to our problems. And you ask yourself, if Europe needs religion, it does because it will give hope. And it will give life to a lifeless body. And it will help us to return to some values. Now we speak of individualism. What happened to the family? It's disappearing. The value of human life. Look at the migrants who are coming here and drowning, and we sit by. Think of the Roma, who have no country, no one to speak for them. And we can all make accusations about all sorts of groups, but we should really look at life in a different way. We need to stop wars and oppression, but we can only do that by a renewed spirit. And as we're in a university setting, in an educational setting, we need to educate people and force them to read again, not only this, but to teach them to read the classics of the centuries so they learn about truth. We need to learn, as religious leaders, how we're going to deal with AI and how that will distort our directions and our values and where we're going. And we need to dispel ignorance, because we are also in the time of ignorance. When we hear of Islamophobia, Romophobia, and religion, when it is true, will dispel superstitions and ignorance and teach people the truth. What we need to do is look at the whole human being and deal with that person's emotional issues, challenges, their inner thoughts. We need to move the negatives and bring in the positives. Remove hatred, anger, rage, guilt, envy, greed, and so much more, and bring in love, peace, forgiveness, and whatever is true in the mind of God and in the hearts of men. What we need to do is balance everything in life. Our relationships with God, with others, and even with ourselves. That's why Europe needs religion. Without religion, we will continue on the dangerous path that we're walking. Religion builds community. It builds fellowship, social bonding. You become part of a group. You have a friend. After all, what a friend we have in Jesus, if you've ever heard the hymn. I'm from the South, and we know those hymns and those spirituals. But even our Orthodox hymnology says, acquire Christ as your friend. And if he is your friend, and you become one with him, you see the world through his eyes, and his mercy, and his love. And if Europe can do that, then it's achieved the goal. By embracing true religion and answering that very question, does Europe need religion? Absolutely. Because without religion, Europe is dead. Thank you very much.
James.
Your Eminence, thank you so much for that rich and really rather inspiring address. So much to think about and tease out, and I feel very privileged to be given the opportunity to begin to do that with you. And I want to begin with the history that you traced of the Christian shaping of Europe according to what Augustine of Hippo called the order of love, through its hospitals and its universities, and that positive influence of Christianity, which I think one can trace right up to really the end of the Cold War and the immensely significant role of the churches in overcoming communism. And I'm curious about, I wonder to what you attribute the embarrassment that Europe then seemed to experience in relation to that past, wanting to distance itself from the significance of Christianity. And I think this sort of reached a peak when the preface to the European Constitution was being drafted, and the French were very adamant that there should be no mention of God. And I remember reading an editorial at the time which said that it was as if no one of significance lived between Marcus Aurelius and Voltaire. This kind of erasure of Christendom as part of our history. So I wanted to what you attribute that, and also do you see that changing? And I think of the coronation of King Charles, at which you were present. I feel a couple of decades ago, people were saying, well, the next coronation can't possibly be a Christian liturgy in the way that it was in the past. And yet it was, and it moved people. And it seemed to make sense to people. And you spoke, you also alluded to growth within your churches. And I wonder, so whether you see a turning tide?
I think gave me a variety of issues to address. Let's look at the first one. I think one of it has to do with ignorance.
Yes.
Absolute ignorance. People don't know the history of Europe in a real way. That's number one. Number two is that in this idea of being modern and even a post-religious society, we want to distance ourselves from some of these things because we believe that they are old-fashioned. And we don't want our children to grow up with this. But it's quite ironic, while there's that one part in society, we have the rise of monasticism, the rise of religious institutions, not only Christian and non-Christian as well. But of course, we're focusing on Christianity. The other thing is, if we look at the first millennium of Christianity, there was just Christianity. The second millennium is that time of division and the naming. Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, eventually Anglicans, Protestants, on down the line, today to the evangelicals. And we distance ourselves from one another. We're now in the age where Christians are finally not only speaking to each other, but we're working together. And we're trying to learn from one another. We're trying to see and understand that we have things in common and much more in common than we have in our differences. Here in the UK, or in England, I'm very happy that we have this religious cooperation, not only amongst Christians, but of course other faith traditions as well, but mainly amongst Christians. And we turned to one another to try to learn what the problems may have been, what the solutions might be. And I think that's coming, if you want, might say, a development and a growth that's happening within the ecumenical movement and spirit, which is critical for us. I don't know if I've answered in some way.
And I suppose you talked about true religion and bad religion, and you acknowledged the presence of bad religion in our own past, that we want to be positive about the Christian heritage of Europe, but that it has its dark side as well. And I'm aware that you're a president of the Council for Christians and Jews. Yes. And I was very heartened to hear that, because I do think that our history of anti-Semitism in the church has been one of our darkest legacies, and the Council for Christians and Jews has been very significant in redressing that since the Holocaust and all that we've learned. So I wonder what role you see for Christians playing in healing the divisions, the interreligious divisions of the past, and therefore contributing to this cohesive, religiously plural Europe, which we now inhabit.
I think it also goes back to the situation or the idea of education and getting to know your neighbor and overcoming prejudice, a blind prejudice, if I might say, which is so often just so sad. But the idea of fanaticism and how it's directed, and we try to blame people for our own faults, our own shortcomings, our problems. Why should one segment of society move forward? Why should we stay behind? Why should they have land and we don't? You know, see, these issues for land and other things are a problem in all parts of the world, wherever there seems to be strife and war and other things. It's all part of our misunderstandings about the other without even knowing the other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we live in a time where not only Christians and Jews work together, but Christians amongst themselves. Now, we have to look at the reality of Christian history. We have the famous term in Christianity of heretics. So it was wonderful to call one another heretics. And of course, those things still happen and go on. But we're looking at the trends, the realities, the issues, the challenges as they really happened and why, and putting them into a different context. I also serve as the president of the Conference of European Churches, which brings me into dialogue with many other people from religious and Christian traditions, which are not my own. I often say that Orthodox theological students should go spend a semester in a Methodist seminary, and Catholic theological students might go to an Anglican seminary. So we have this exchange, we get to know each other and each other's theologies. We don't even know what makes us different, what's so different about our theologies and our understanding. We just throw terms around. I made the statement earlier, I always told my students things, and it was one of those that you should really know what the church teaches and not what you think it teaches. Because we have a tradition of also of a grandmother theology many times. Well, my grandmother told me so. Or, you know, if I might, just a quick story. There was a family, and the mother went home with that roast from the market and cut off the end and then put it in the pan to bake it. And the daughter said, well, why are you doing that? Said, well, your grandmother, my mother always did it, so I've always done it. But why? Well, we'll ask her. So they went and asked the grandmother, why do you do that? She said, because it didn't fit in the pan that I had. And you see, without having any real understanding of why it was happening, she just continued this. And we continue our misconceptions, our misunderstandings, our blaming, without even knowing the other and the realities.
I wonder, if I may just intervene there, that clearly, as you've said, respect is at the heart of faith, of different faiths. As you've alluded to, understanding religious literacy, an understanding of other faiths, indeed an understanding of faith, seems to be in decline. And I wonder where you find optimism here.
Well, I find the optimism because I'm hoping that universities will introduce courses in comparative religion. And not only that, I used to encourage students to take a class called The Bible as Literature, so they're at least familiar with scripture. You know, don't watch things at the movies, such as the movie about Noah. It's so distorted in many ways. Or I was commenting about the movie that's now on Netflix, Troy. Many distortions and misconceptions. But it happens also with religious things. The Last Temptation of Christ. You know, I asked a young woman, she said, oh, it was wonderful. Now I learned so much about Jesus. I said, have you ever read the four Gospels? She said, no, I didn't have to. I saw the movie. But the movie and the gospel tradition are two different things. So we need to encourage people to read, to study, to understand, and to learn language and expressions, to learn what Passover really means, to learn what Easter was all about, to talk about the resurrection, and not to be afraid to discuss these things, even in public.
Well, I need to resist the temptation to give too big a plug to the LSE Faith Centre and the religious literacy work that we're doing, but suffice it to say that everything you say resonates. And also through my involvement in Anglican theological education, I do share this this real concern that at the formational level, we need to be engaging across churches. And I mean, that brings me to you alluded to a lot of the dark challenges that we're facing in Europe now, the prospect of growing, of an escalation of the conflict in Ukraine, human trafficking, mass migration because of climate change, these kinds of things. And I'm reminded of Archbishop Desmond Tutu's words when he was fighting apartheid, that apartheid is too strong for a divided church. And I wonder what issues you believe in Europe are too strong for a divided church that we should really rally around.
Well, all issues can be too strong for a divided church. And that's what I alluded to earlier. We need to remember that we're all Christians. And we need to raise the banner, raise the cross, and follow the cross. Those who are in my office often hear me say to them, all we have to do is look to the cross and keep walking. And I think that's what Christians have to do, is to look to that cross and keep walking together. You know, in the deep south, they're saying, we shall overcome. And they walked hand in hand. Archbishop Iakovos of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese marched with Martin Luther King. I said it takes people, takes boldness. It takes daring spirit. And that's what he had, and that's what religious leaders need to have today, to speak out against injustice and to work together, walking toward that cross, that crucifixion, but always knowing that behind the crucifixion is the resurrection.
You speak very beautifully of raising the cross and that leading to a solidarity with the marginalized. You spoke of the voiceless. But we must be aware that when Others speak of raising the cross. They perhaps think of Constantine in this sign conquer, and they resurrect fantasies of more ecclesial power. And we see all around the world the dangers of religious nationalism today, across the religions, actually. And of course, including among our brothers and sisters in Russia, where the close association of church and state is not good. So how do we resist that, the temptations of religious nationalism?
That goes back to education. I'm personally, of course, against national churches. You know, societies and people are free. If you're a good priest, a good pastor, your congregation will remain with you. If you preach the wrong values and guide and lead people the wrong way, they're going to leave you. So what we have to do is be sure that people who are guiding and leading preach true religion. It's a very sad situation in our world when religious leaders promote war. They bless weapons. We saw that happen in the former Yugoslavia, all sorts of issues. When people were thirsting for freedom, I remember a religious leader from Hungary saying the churches were filled. People always run to the churches when they need something, when they want something. But when their dream, their wishes are fulfilled or perhaps accomplished, oh, well, thank you, God, now I'll go on my way and I'll see you in the next time I want or need. But it doesn't work that way. You know, the church is here like the ark to preserve us and to keep us. The ark filled with all the animals. And to remember that even in the ark, we have the snakes. We forget about them. So let's remember that we have those issues as well. And we have to learn how to deal with the snakes. And, of course, to keep them at a distance and maybe tame them. But we also need to keep maybe certain religious leaders and ideologies at a distance, as they're not part of the true faith, the true religion, true Christianity. No Christian would really want to go to war. No Christian would pick up a gun to kill someone else. We have to really give account for those things.
And perhaps the last thing for me before we open it up, you clearly have a passion for education and a knowledge about education, and you've spoken about theological education in the churches. You threw something into your address about not believing in prayer in schools, and it just raised a question for me for Europe. We know that schools are very important in thinking about the cohesion of our societies. And you sort of have two schools of thought. You have those people who say, well, in a multi-faith society, you really need secular schools where people don't practice their faith. That's for the home, that's for the place of worship. Or the direction I think this country's really gone of saying, well, you have schools with a religious tradition, and what we need to do in a plural society is expand that to schools of other faiths and make sure that they don't become sectarian, that they engage with one another, and that's the project. But it sounded like you were more on the first side. I'm just curious what you envisage.
There's no problem with having schools where people have different faith traditions and to study and learn about religion, of course. We can't be ignorant. In my undergraduate degree, the emphasis in the religious aspect of that was in Judaic thought, in Judaism. So there's no problem, but it's up to my family, my parents, my community to teach me and to teach others about our faith tradition. I can't expect a government to do that. And how do I know what the government teachers are teaching? And I have my faith and my trust in them, because that puts us into very dangerous waters when it comes to all sorts of issues concerning religious theology, philosophy, ideology. Who will teach? You just can't put in someone to plug the hole. That square peg doesn't quite fit into that round hall.
Thank you. If we may, given the time, could we open it up and invite questions, if that is okay? Perhaps we'll start with a couple. If you could just introduce yourself. I think there's a microphone coming to you.
Good evening, yeah, Bernard Casey, of this place at one stage and various others. Thank you very much. That was encouraging. I wanted to take you up on one point. I decided I was not going to ask you about fractions within the Orthodox Church in Eastern Europe, although I was tempted to originally. I actually wanted to ask you a bit about how you talked about the first century as being the first millennium as being a millennium of a single Christianity. I mean, I'm an economist, but I spent quite a lot of time, because doing too much economics is bad for one, studying religious disputes in 4th, 5th, and 6th century Constantinople. And the extent of division struck me as quite enormous, the extent of excommunication. One of the things that I had as a president of a college which I studied in Oxford, he was a medieval church historian, and he thought the world had been going downhill since about the 13th century. Medieval church historian. After reading this, I actually thought, poor old Jack Southern, he said, I was very young in those days, so I thought, you know, who is this old fellow? What does he think about? Actually, after reading this, I decided it had been going downhill since about the 4th century. So I don't sort of really subscribe to this single, you know, sort of unified Christianity in those days. Could you comment upon that? Thank you.
Then I think there's a question here. If you could just
answer to the first one.
Oh, please go ahead.
Well, I just want, it's not that everyone was one big happy family, but they didn't call themselves by all sorts of titles and names. Those came much later. And believe it or not, we talk about the Great Schism in 1054. Do you know the East and the West continue to have communion after that? Even though we say that that's the breaking point, it was still intercommunion.
Thank you. Let's take your question.
Well, thank you very much. I had a question.
Could you just say who you are, please?
I'm Julian. I'm a student at LSE doing a master's. Question, because you say many of the issues that are plaguing Europe at the moment could be resolved by Christianity, everything. But when I think about it, many of these issues have always been present, even then when there was a more Christian spirit. I know you alluded to, well, different types of faith, some the true faith and some extremes. But what is the guarantee that, for example, if Europe starts becoming more religion or thus more religion, how will these issues really be tamed if they've always been, I guess, part of like nationalism, populism, and everything?
I'm trying to give concise answers. So I never said that Christianity was the answer, but I said true religion is, and education and the understanding of true religion, because true religion does not promote conflict or greed or the desire for land and so many other things. People can work together. That comes through true religion. But a bad religion, okay?
Other questions, please. Could we take the gentleman here?
Hi there. Hugh from the LSE. I'm a master's student here. Thank you very much for your speech today, Archbishop. You've spoken of true religion, and I wonder how you may frame that with regards to secular pursuits for meaning.
Secular
pursuits for meaning, in ourselves or in community. We can take examples like social justice, environmental justice. How would you frame them with the idea of true religion?
I don't believe in the terms social justice, because the justice of society is not always the justice of God and the justice of the church. But I believe that justice comes out of the church. And there's no reason to characterize justice, because if it's true justice, it will really be not only true, but necessary. In the same way, in many theological societies and schools, people speak of liberation theology, right? Theology, feminist theology, and on down the line. For me, in the church, there's no need for any of that. Theology is theology. Why do we have to break it up into little packages? And the only liberation is the liberation from sin. You have to look at it in a different light and context. So we see things maybe a little bit differently, in a different light and manner. Are you a theological student?
Yeah. Not in the least, economic history.
Oh, okay.
I've done research in religion at another university.
Okay. Other questions? I'm sorry, could we take the gentleman right at the back? Yes, you, sir. Yes. If you wait for the microphone.
Thank you. Good evening, Your Grace. My name is Tobias. I'm a master's degree student at the Key.
If you could perhaps put the microphone close to your mouth.
Oh, I'm so sorry. My name is Tobias. I'm a student at King's College London, a master's degree in religious studies. And I have long been particularly interested in the points of unity between the Latin and Greek traditions of the church. And over the past 100 or so years, we have seen an increased interest in aspects of orthodoxy within the West, thanks to the work of figures such as Andrew Luth and the late Calistus Ware of blessed memory. In what ways would you say, Your Grace, is orthodoxy changing in the West? Is perhaps the orthodox tradition adopting aspects of the Latin Church or otherwise?
Well, there it is on certain levels. In some understandings of Orthodox Christianity, there's now something called the Western Rite. Okay, so that's one expression. Number two, if you go to some countries where there are Orthodox communities, there are now choirs, mixed men and women. The structures of the church in architecture. So there are influences in all different ways. Even language. So there are influences and also the desire to embrace these things into our own tradition because we find them right and true. And the last thing that I'll tell you, amongst the many other things, though, is the rediscovery of our own saints, Saint Cuthbert, Saint Patrick, so many Orthodox saints. Here, Saint Alban. In this country, there are saints as well. So we share all that.
Thank you. And then there's a lot of questions. Perhaps if we could take the gentleman on this row first, please, and we'll come back to everyone.
My name is Nick Hale. I'm one of your flock. Happens.
You poor thing.
I would like to ask you, you mentioned no Christian would pick up a gun to go to war.
No, I didn't say to go to war.
Would.
I said to kill someone.
To kill someone.
As if murder and things like that.
Would a Christian pick up a gun either to defend himself or his neighbor?
You don't have to necessarily kill someone with a gun. You can shoot them in the leg or the foot. And stop them.
Yes, but a gun.
But if we were to distribute our wealth and to share what we have, people might not attack us. But there's the desire for land and greed and possessions and who's right and who defines things.
So you would say that a Christian would never launch a missile rather than picking up a gun. He wouldn't launch a missile.
I would hope he wouldn't, or she. We have to include the women.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Then I think there's a gentleman, yes, here at the back, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Theogenes Koumas. Your Eminence, you have argued a strong case tonight, so hopefully some of us or all of us will leave at the end of the tonight's proceedings, we'll leave with some divine wisdom. But perhaps how your case, what you're arguing, is what one might describe as a Christian socialism. But the question I want to ask is a big why, is because at the beginning of your speech, you said about bad religion. Now, historically, there have been a number of atrocities committed by the church or representatives of the church. And to name but a few, for example, the sack of Constantinople, 1204, which in effect was the beginning of the end of Constantinople. Then we had the Spanish Inquisition, which lasted for about 400 years. Then in the 1530s, we had the dissolution of the monasteries by King Henry VIII, aided and abetted by his chief minister, Thomas Cromwell. So that's three that I've described. But more recent, we've had the Russian Orthodox Church, which has been complicit with the anachronism of Vladimir Putin. So speak why. Why have these events have occurred? Thank you.
They've occurred for one simple reason. And that's because they did it by free choice. God gave each of us the ability to decide and to choose. And we have the ability in life to make the decision for each and every day. That's why in the Gospel of John, one of my other favorite passages, it says that they loved more the glory of men than the glory of God. Igapisan gartin doxan ton anthropon, maoni pertin doxa tu Theou. The glory of God is humility and love. It's not a political socialism that I'm preaching. Search the scriptures, feed the poor, clothe the naked, feed the hungry, minister to the widow and to the orphans. Those are scriptural passages. We just need to live them. But the others who have gone to war, whether it be during the Inquisition or the dissolution of monasteries, that's because of fanaticism sometimes. It's also because of fear. And the last thing I would say, it's because of insecurity. You destroy your enemies, then you don't have to be afraid.
Thanks. Other questions, if we can take the gentleman up here, please.
Good evening. My name is Dimitris, and I'm here because I was told that you are a very good speaker. So I came to see myself, and it is true. My question.
Sometimes they get things right.
My question goes back to the subject of tonight's talk. Does Europe need religion? Is it religion that Europe needs, or is it dialogue? And you did comment, you did pick up on dialogue, especially during the Q&A. But going back to one of your points about the surveys you've read, where I think you mentioned that in France and in the Czech Republic, people, the majority say that they don't believe in God. But I hear from people who are either atheists or agnostics that they say they believe in humanity. So is dialogue the answer?
You can have dialogue between a religion and a government. You can have dialogue between different religions. But I think a person must dialogue with himself or herself first to decide on the path he or she might want to take. You notice I'm careful with the pronoun references to make sure that there's equality. Before God, there is always equality. But, you know, I believe that religion is at least part of the answer to the problems of Europe. And if we address the real issues and we have good leadership, we can lead people into a better world and a better society. One of the problems is, I stated several times, the failure of real political leadership. And I can give you all sorts of examples. I've lived around the world. I've lived in several countries and studied in several. And I can tell you about failed political leadership. What we need is to have good leaders to guide the flock. And if the leadership is good and true, you will walk on a sure path. Scripture says, go neither to the right nor to the left, but walk on the king's highway, the king's path, the path of Christ, at least for Christians. And if we walk that path, then we're assured we're walking the right way. The problem is people go to the right and to the left, not politically, with all sorts of ideologies, all sorts of things that pull us. You know, if you look at the Orthodox icon of the ladder of divine ascent, you see all the demons pulling us down. And that's what's happening in our society. The demons are pulling us down. And what are some of these demons? Well, greed, hunger for power, hunger for authority, alcoholism, the problem with drugs. And where is the church or the churches to help ease these issues and these challenges for a suffering society? I don't know if I answered the question or not.
Please, sir, here.
I'm sorry, we had one a lady finally.
I love the reference to demons, Your Eminence. I'm thinking of the paradox that Schumann, one of the founders of the European Union, is a candidate at the moment for canonization. And yet when Pope Benedict Joseph Ratzinger asked the European Commission for a mention of Christianity in the prologue to the Constitution, it was absolutely refused. Whereas this week, France is about to introduce into its constitution the right to abortion in the French constitution. So we've got some very strange things going on here. I hope you'll forgive me, but I think in the United Kingdom, it's very difficult for us to grasp that militant laïcité in the commission is the fruit of Freemasonry in France, Spain, Italy, and Portugal. Now, LSE here is 10 yards from Masonic headquarters in Great Queen Street. British Freemasonry starts in Edinburgh in 1737, has never, ever been anti-religion. It couldn't be because the king has always been a Freemason until Charles, the first one to refuse. But George the VI, George the V, were all Freemasons. So when the king is supreme governor of the Church of England and a Freemason, it's quite clear that Freemasonry can never be anti-clerical. France, Spain, Italy, and Portugal, Greece, sadly, I know nothing about, but in the countries I do know, France, Spain, Italy, and Portugal, Freemasonry is militantly anti-Christian, viciously anti-Christian. And I believe we're paying the price. Those of us who voted no in the referendum to get out of the European Union were not voting because of the European Union. We were voting to show our rejection of atheist Freemasonry in the European Commission. And coming back to your snakes on the ark, I hope you find a way of taming them.
Well, you didn't have a question, but I'll make one comment. And that is, about 2 weeks ago, other religious leaders and I were invited to the European Commission to speak about the influence and the purpose of religion in European society. So we were allowed to make a statement and a presentation. And as you see, I'm quite clear with what I want to say.
Thank you. Your Eminence, I wonder if we could
pick up on the issue which is so topical in Greece today. In fact, this week, on Thursday, the Greek Parliament will vote on legislation to make legal same-sex marriage. Many, I imagine, many Orthodox Christians in Greece will feel that this is a just and fair development. Majority will not, but some genuine believers, those who feel that they have a true religion, will feel that this is a necessary change. So my point is that it poses difficulties for both the church as an institution, but also for a variety of well-meaning Christians in Greece. And of course, it's receiving so much attention. What kind of accommodation do you think is possible on issues like this between the church and a secular power?
First, you speak of Greece and the nation. The issues there are to be decided by the Greek people and the citizens of the Hellenic Republic, just like the issues here in England or the UK are to be decided by the citizens here. Number two, the issues voiced by the Church of Greece are voiced by the Church of Greece. I do not belong to the Church of Greece. I belong to the Ecumenical Patriarchate. And the Ecumenical Patriarch, though, in the Synod, made a statement. We may not always agree in the decisions between church and state. And the representatives will vote and make a decision. It will not satisfy or dissatisfy everyone, but they must make or have a vote and make a decision. But there have been situations in the past and in contemporary society where the church and civil leadership do not agree. The issue of abortion. What happens to the rights of the unborn child? We speak of the rights of the mother. And of course, it's very difficult for a single male to speak of the issues for a woman. We don't know what it is like to suffer the consequences either of rape or abuse or other things. But the church has positions on some things. And the church and the state do not always agree. And it is not only the issue of abortion. Let's look at capital punishment. I told you in 1016 it was outlawed, the law of Yaroslav. But look at Russia today. Or look at the United States, where there is indeed capital punishment. So the church may have a position on something, and society and governments may not always agree with the position of the church, and the church may not always agree with the positions of the government. And those who complain about things, not only these issues or others, I say, did you bother to vote? Did you vote for the person who expresses your vision, your philosophy, your ideology? Well, I didn't vote. You have no right to speak. How can you complain when you didn't actively participate? So there are so many factors that come into this. We have to be very objective about things and look at things in a real manner. It will be a very interesting challenge because we look at the nations which claim to be Christian, correct? And preach Christianity and all these things. Some of them have the highest abortion rates. Some of them have legalized prostitution. So we see that there are inconsistencies between the values supposedly which are held and then those things which are practiced. So we will wait to see what the results will be. We will. You're a good politician, won't I?
Thank you. We will. Sadly, I think we're out of time. In a moment, I'm going to give the thanks which are so truly meant. We don't proselytize, but we do market the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE. And I'd just like to alert you to our next major event, which is this coming Monday. And we will be hosting Stefanos Kazalakis, the leader of Syriza and leader of the Greek opposition, in conversation. And this is 6:30 on Monday evening. Tickets are available online. And perhaps some of the issues we've been discussing may come up that evening. When we are blessed with such an eminent public speaker who's covered so many different issues, we would like to show appreciation of our guest. And we have a very small gift from the LSE to pass to you. Again, of course, modesty is a great virtue, I think. So perhaps when you open the gift, you'll think of that particular phrase, modesty. can you please join me in giving a very warm thank you to your editor? Thank you to my colleague, James Walters from the Faith Centre. And it's a great opportunity now for us to move just outside this lecture theatre for the wine reception. Thank you.
Thank you.